On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jensen and Holes' Winter Distraction. We are continuing to talk to people in the true crime world while we prepare for Season 4. And today, we're going to delve into one of the most notorious unsolved cases in history. It's a case we touched on in Season 2, Episode 20, but didn't get to fully explore.
We have the distinct pleasure to chat with author and historian Hallie Reubenhold. And her book, The Five, focuses on the victims of Jack the Ripper and told their stories and really flipped the Jack the Ripper narrative on its head. Her expertise hasn't just shined in her books, but she also serves as a historical consultant on programs on the BBC. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Paul, we met beforehand and I introduced you guys. We first met in London. In
2 years ago.
2 years ago in Whitechapel. And I was interviewing you for my book that's coming out in July about, you know, the whole idea is that in the genre of true crime, you've got, you know, it's starting to get better, but you have so many venues that won't cover murders of sex workers. And yet the most famous, notorious, whatever you want to call it, killer in the history of true crime is somebody that murdered sex workers. And that is true, but not completely true, as you were telling me, because some of them weren't not necessarily sex workers. And, you know, we had a fantastic conversation there. And I have to add this. I actually put, when I was writing in the manuscript, I was writing like how much of a badass you are and how I was a little scared of you because you because you are a little scary in the sense where just like you just were. I think it might be the you're from, I think you have a Santa Monica and London accent, which is very sort of, yeah. And then my I remember my editor having this conversation, was like, why was she scary? Were you in danger? I was like, you know what? It had to be their moment. I have to take it out. So that's out. But thank you so much for joining us. I really do appreciate it. It's going to be great.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I remember that day really well. And I was actually a little bit scared of you because I realized like, oh, this guy's he's a real true crime aficionado, you know, and he knows all of his stuff and he's here to investigate this. And, you know, he's like, you know, a grand pajander and I'm just nothing.
No, stop. You knocked the ball out of the park, which is an American term, by the way. I don't know what the cricket version would be. But
don't worry. I speak both languages, so it's not a problem. Well versed in both.
So let's start with why you tackled this project and why you wanted to do something that we do all the time here. And we've been really fighting for this narrative of putting it back on the victims, especially in the most, you know, the case that kind of kicked off the entire genre.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you kind of put your finger on it there, which is that, you know, when I was looking at this case, I wanted to write something which basically highlighted women's lives, women who lived on the margins. And I had written a book already about 18th century sex workers, which became very popular. It was called The Covent Garden Ladies, and it later became Harlots for the BBC and then Hulu as well. And I am really, really fascinated in the untold stories really of the majority of people in history. And I wanted to do something similar for 19th century sex workers and women on the margins. And I thought, well, who are the most famous sex workers in the 19th century? And I automatically thought, oh, well, that'll be the victims of Jack the Ripper. And then I started, you know, reading, and I was thinking, well, where are all the books about these women's lives? You know, not the sort of, you know, paragraph in this book and the half a chapter in this book, but like, where is the concerted study about these women's lives? I want to know who they were. I want to know about their perspective, how, you know, I wanted to see how it was that these atrocities happened. And I wanted to see it from their perspective. And it just really shocked me that there was just no space for that in the current canon of works on Jack the Ripper. And most everything that had been written for the past 130 years or so was just really focused on who he was, on the policing, speculating on suspects. And I just thought, you know, it's like, as is the case with any crime, you know, if you always do the same things when you're investigating a crime, you're always going to get the same answers. You're going to look over the same stuff over and over again. If you look in a completely different direction, if you take a different approach, you're going to see things from a completely different angle, and you're going to get a much fuller picture of what actually happened. And I think that's certainly something that writing The Five has brought to this particular canon of work.
Yeah, you know, and I've never done a real deep dive on the Jack the Ripper series at all. I'm, of course, aware of the circumstances, but if I were to be digging into this case, you know, the first thing I'd want to know is, well, who were the victims? You know, it's victimology is huge.
Yeah.
And that often can direct an investigation, just depending on, you know, the type of crimes that were committed. So the work that you've done, I'm very curious. You know, it seems like I would be starting with what you've done so I can know who the five victims were and then go from there. Now, you are trying to figure out who these five women were. How did you go about and do that?
Well, I mean, what I think is surprising to so many people is just how much information there is out there about people who lived on the margins. And, you know, we're particularly fortunate in that these women were murder victims. So there were, you know, in some cases, interviews with family members that gave much more detail than or directed certainly what I was looking for. But the interesting thing is this, is that obviously we don't know who Jack the Ripper was, and we'll probably, I would say, I'm fairly confidently never know sure who Jack the Ripper was. But actually what we do know is who these women were. And we know much, much more about them than we will ever know about him. So, for example, you know, we know their names, with the exception of Mary Jane Kelly. I mean, that's the big enigma, is we really don't know who she was. But with the others, the other four, you know, we know where they were born. We know who their parents were. We know where they grew up. We know all of these aspects of their lives. And yet nobody has ever thought to kind of piece all of this together and then frame it within Victorian, poor Victorian women's lives, because, you know, they only had really a sort of, there was a very narrow range of possibilities for poor women in the Victorian era. So these women's lives are going to kind of fit on that scale. And I mean, it's incredibly revealing when you look at all of this stuff. And I think it just completely changes the picture of how we will think of these crimes.
Now, as far as the, you know, so many, not a lot of the buildings that are around that area, it's a pretty small area where these were taking place, in the Spitalfields and by the church. And, you know, you still have the church there. You still have the pub right there. And but obviously, you've got a lot of modern things here or there. But describe what life was like then. You know, I know that the park around the church had the nickname of Itchy Park. You know, what was that about? What was life like there? And what was it like, particularly at night? Like, when, if you were walking down the street in that neighborhood in East London, what would you have seen?
Well, I mean, if you look at, for example, William Booth's study about Whitechapel, and William Booth was a social reformer, and really just right after the Ripper murders, so in 1889, he started charting poverty in London. And what he and I want to call them enumerators, but they weren't enumerators, investigators did, was they walked the streets with police constables, and they walked the beat with police constables, and the police pointed out, well, you know, this is obviously, that's a, you know, a brothel, and that's a, you know, that's a place where lots of criminals live, and that's this and that's that. And they would observe things on the street, and then they would come to this assessment of how criminal a particular area was. And Whitechapel, certainly certain streets in Whitechapel, were designated as being almost entirely criminal. So he color-coded these maps. And so you have certain streets that are jet black, which indicates highly criminal. And then you have different colors that indicate, you know, these are poor people, but they were, you know, hardworking poor, and these were well off, et cetera, et cetera. So Whitechapel was, there were a number of streets in Whitechapel, like Dorset Street, for example, that were just no-go areas. And then there were other parts of Whitechapel, and this is the bit that often gets left out of the narrative. You know, there were shops, there were shopkeepers that lived there, there were, you know, there were factories, there were all sorts of things. You know, it was a neighborhood that was comprised of a wide variety of social classes. But the thing about this particular area was that now it was one of many similar slums in London. And again, there's this kind of erroneous belief that if people were very poor in London, you know, you just all end up in Whitechapel. That's not true. There are lots of areas like King's Cross, places like Paddington, things like that. You know, these were very bad areas too. Chelsea, Westminster, you know, areas that are very wealthy now. But particular part of London was full of lodging houses, and lodging houses were referred to at the time as homes for the homeless. So people who were destitute and for whom, you know, a couple of pennies could secure them a bed for the night, you know, in a flea infested bed in a rat infested room. And, you know, these people lived hand to mouth, day by day, trying to get bits of labor where they could, quite often begging. There was a lot of begging and a large itinerant population and a lot of criminality, every type of criminality you can imagine, as you would find in any slum, in anywhere around the world at any time in history. And so, you know, Whitechapel really acquired a reputation as being a real sink of poverty, of destitution, of, you know, depravity. And so it was believed that when the Ripper started killing, it was like almost inevitable, mm-hmm, that such an area would breed such a criminal.
Well, let's take I want to go through the victims. Let's start with Mary Nichols, who went by Polly, and how we don't have to get deep into her, which you certainly did. You know, she had been married. She had five children. Her husband cheated on her. She started drinking. She moves into Whitechapel, and on the 24th, she goes to a place called the White House, which was like sort of mixed lodging. Taking it from there, you know, what is her, you know, like you were saying, her life was like on a daily basis, like trying to get the next drink and then the next bed.
Yeah.
And what was going on with her that night?
Well, but I think we kind of almost have to back the story up a little bit more. Okay. Because to really understand how people got there, you have to kind of understand what they were facing and what they were up against. And Polly had spent the better part of, about 8 years in and out of workhouses and casual wards. Workhouses, in a nutshell, I think everybody knows about the workhouse, you know, and how kind of you would go there if you were poor. And it wasn't like a prison. You could discharge yourself at any time, but it was miserable and you were fed meager rations and you had to do really degrading work. And the circumstances in which you were there were, you know, would be very, very shameful for a Victorian. So she spent a lot of time in and out of the workhouse. She would, and also casual wards, and casual wards were kind of short stay workhouses, and the street. And then she was able to get a job as a servant. A Baptist family took her in, you know, part of this is kind of rehabilitation. That didn't work out for her. But this was often the pattern for a lot of people in Polly's situation. And this is exactly how the Victorian era would describe homelessness, mm-hmm, you know, and going hand in hand with homelessness was alcoholism and, you know, addiction as it is today. It's exactly the same sort of combination of things.
What about, you know, another thing with the homelessness today, you talk about addiction, but also mental illness was obviously a lot of it was not diagnosed back then. But I have to think that if you're making the comparison between then and now, mental illness was definitely on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, also, you know, you have to think, you know, today we talk a lot about trauma, and we're able to identify trauma and understand its impact on people's lives. I mean, back then, I mean, people lived in almost a constant state of trauma, and there was no understanding it. It was just life. And, you know, and life was often incredibly violent. I mean, it was brutal, you know. Child mortality, infant mortality was very high. People got sick and died. You know, women could be left completely destitute if their husbands died. And all of this stuff happened very suddenly. And people found it very hard to deal with, as you would. And drink really was one of the only escapes. And it was very hard to actually remove yourself from alcohol, because alcohol was everywhere. Yeah. And it was in everything.
The night of her murder, she had been at the Frying Pan pub wearing a new bonnet. And then she went to one of these lodging houses to try and get a room, but she didn't have money. And then she said she would come back with the money. And then she was discovered at 3:30 a.m. A guy was walking to work down Bucks Row and saw her and saw sort of like this bundle. What was the... And obviously, you know, Paul, we can bring you in here as we start talking about the crime scene. But what was the position like, and as you've looked at this, what did you think happened?
Well, it's interesting because this is like, you know, really quite the controversial bit that I think is interesting, because everybody just assumes that a woman out at night in a bad part of town is a prostitute, you know, in the 19th century and even today. And it was the same case with the Yorkshire Ripper as well. Basically 100 years later, everybody assumed that the women that were killed by the Yorkshire Ripper were killed because they were out on the street because they were prostitutes. Okay.
By the way, we use sex worker. Sorry.
I'm speaking in the parlance
You're
of the time.
Speaking in the parlance of the time. Yes.
Yes.
Like
absolutely.
Issue Park and yes, yeah, I know.
Absolutely.
I completely understand. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So basically, there is a lot of evidence that Polly was begging. In fact, she turns up in the record on a number of occasions having begged. And what there isn't any record of is Polly actually selling sex. There's hearsay. There's somebody summarizing something who said it to a policeman who put it on a form. Her husband, when he is at the inquest and talking about her and her life, never once uses the word, again, parlance of the time, prostitute. Mm-hmm. Her friend, Ellen Holland, who actually lived with her, just made an outright denial that she was in any way involved in sex work. And so where this comes from is this kind of supposition that a woman outside at night was obviously looking to sell herself. Speaking to people who are experts in 19th century sex work, they said that, you know, actually the time and the geography of that doesn't fit because there weren't. Most of the sex workers at that time would not be outside. That wasn't a location where people worked on the streets and solicited at night.
Right.
So it's lots of things just don't add up.
You know, and I think that's sort of an important thing that I was going to ask about. You did a great job describing this area. You know, for me, now we know some of these victims were involved in sex work. What exactly was the culture of sex work in this area at the time? You know, was there a stroll area? Did they work out of a brothel? Did they have their own apartments? Were there pimps, etc.?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were, like many things, the sex trade is incredibly nuanced and incredibly stratified. And there are women like, and we'll come to Mary Jane Kelly, who were sex workers, who were career sex workers. And they were parts like Commercial Street, where women did stand outside. But again, at this time, after 1885, women had to be very careful because of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, which cracked down on brothels, which cracked down on open solicitation, and it made it much more difficult. A lot of women from this area, if they actually were intent on making money, wouldn't have traded in the East End. They would have gone into the West End, which was the center of the sex trade at the time. that isn't to say that there wouldn't be women looking for work and things like that. But also there's this conflation of, and the police recognized this at the time as well, as did a lot of moralizers, this conflation of what was the behavior of a destitute woman who was looking for a bed for the night, a woman who was a sex worker. Because, you know, this whole thing, this is a very gray area of what, you know, what was casual prostitution? You know, any woman, bearing in mind, in the Victorian era, any woman who had sex outside of marriage was called a prostitute, in quotes.
Yeah.
So a woman like Polly Nichols, for example, who had split up with her husband, if she, you know, had sex with another man, well, as was the case with Annie Chapman, who shacked up with another man, or Catherine Eddowes, who was with another man who she wasn't married to, two men she wasn't married to, that automatically would have made them a quote-unquote prostitute. So, you know, it's such a gray area that to say, oh, well, they were all prostitutes. They were all, you know, casually selling sex. Well, we don't know that. There's no way of proving that at all.
And it's looking at this from two different perspectives. You know, we are talking about Polly's perspective, you know, the women's perspective on, you know, they're trying to get by in life. And then you have the offender's perspective, who sees Polly out at night.
Absolutely.
And is he thinking, is she a sex worker? Is he targeting her because of that? Or is it because she's a victim of opportunity? This is now assessing.
Absolutely.
Who the offender is. Yeah.
And it might not even matter to the offender either. And certainly to a Victorian, she would be a sex worker. But to us, you know, whether we can still call these women, quote unquote, prostitutes, with the label, with all of the shame and everything that's attached to that Victorian word prostitute today, when we understand what their circumstances were a bit better, when we understand that the complexities of being a destitute woman at that time were incredibly gray, you know, do we continue to use a Victorian label, which is full of scorn and shame, and just paint everybody with broad brushstrokes?
Sure.
So, Paul, taking a look at, you know, we have a short description of the crime scene. If you want to run that down.
Sure. So Polly's initially found. And you'll have to, I think both of you have been at this location. So this Charles Cross was walking to work down Bucks Row when he saw a bundle near 1876 Board School. So is this a residential area? Is this a commercial area where her body is located at?
Well, it's kind of both, actually. I mean, commercial areas and residential areas were, you know, pretty much the same thing in that area.
Okay.
But so there's a board school, and a board school is like an official school. But she was found up against a gate and right near a group of houses as well.
Would this be an area where she would naturally just be walking, or is this more of an area where she could have been pulled to because it was more out of sight?
It was, I mean, that sort of area, it's likely she was walking. Now, you have to understand that Whitechapel has a very, very large homeless community. And that's the one aspect of this which doesn't seem to factor in a lot of the discussion, and, you know, either then or now. You know, the homeless community wasn't enumerated. People weren't paying attention to the numbers. And, you know, it's estimated in any given night in somewhere like Hyde Park, there are like 600 to 800 homeless people sleeping. And Itchy Park is known as a place where homeless people sleep. But we know from what journalists say that there were homeless people sleeping in doorways, up against gates, you know, which is where Polly was found, in yards, which is where Annie Chapman was found.
So a lot of potential witnesses are out there, even at this time of night.
How many there actually are? Well, the other interesting thing is, obviously, nobody heard anything, or we can't be actually sure that anybody heard anything, because the witness testimony from the Ripper case is flawed and it's really questionable because, you know, you kind of have to hold it up against the same measure that you hold witness statements today. Yeah. And we know today what we know about witnesses and what we know about witness psychology is often people hear things that has absolutely nothing to do with a crime.
Sure.
And so we're just assuming that all of these witness statements and things like that pertain to the crime. Mm-hmm. You know, this, as far as we know, nobody heard anything in any of these women's cases.
And I know as I'm trying to assess, you know, the crime scene, and I'm going to kind of get onto what this offender did to her. But, you know, it's also what I call the barrier to offense. You know, is this an offender that is comfortable moving around in the area? Does he stand out? You know, and knowing that there's potentially all this homeless that is out there. And this is not necessarily a hidden area. This isn't like a trap door type situation where he potentially grabbed Polly and moved her to a very isolated location. You know, that gives me some insight into, you know, the risk this offender is willing to take in order to accomplish the crime, as well as his comfort level in the area.
Yeah.
And now this is at 3:30 a.m. when Polly's body's found. Her body is still warm, you know, and do we know what kind of temperature this was? It's August.
I mean, it's not going to be that cold at night. Okay. I don't know what the exact temperature was.
No. I think, you know, the fact that her body is still warm, I mean, because of it's not a super cold area, you know, we're dealing with probably a fairly large time window that she had could have been killed prior to her body being found in this particular case. Now, this first responding officer, he noticed this blood oozing and that her throat had been cut twice as determined. Vagina had been stabbed twice. And at the mortuary, a gash on her abdomen was visible and that she had been disemboweled. But there's no further characterization in terms of what it meant by disemboweled. Are we just talking that maybe there's some loops of intestine that was sticking out of this gash, or was she missing any of her internal organs?
I'm going to just say right now that I very deliberately did not spend a lot of time looking at the wounds because that's not really, I think I spent a lot of time looking at the life story, not the death story. I'm not really interested in the death because I think that's been covered really extensively. And I just wanted to know these women in life. So, you know, the scene of the crime and how these women were murdered, you know, that's for other people. So I really can't speak to that because I don't know.
So Hallie, one of the things that we had talked about that I thought was, you know, there were two very controversial things that have pitted kind of you against the Ripperologists, and the Ripperologists are pretty, you know, I mean, these are people that, you know, and we see this, Paul, we've seen this with Golden State Killer. People have their theories and you attack their theory or even question their theory, and they go on the attack.
Yeah.
But you had mentioned two things that I thought were really interesting. The first is that these women may not have all been sex workers.
Yeah.
The second was that some of them may have actually been sleeping.
Yeah.
When they were murdered.
Yeah.
Which completely goes against the narrative of, and the sort of, you know, the infamy of this guy that is walking with a knife and, you know, the vision that we have of Jack the Ripper as the prototypical original serial killer. And you're saying he very well could have, some of these women he very well could have killed while they were sleeping on the street.
Yeah, I think it struck me that this was just something that nobody had actually even contemplated. Because, I mean, from what we know about the way they were killed. First of all, I think a lot of people are really surprised that Jack the Ripper didn't have sex with his victims. You know, that's something that really surprises people because they think of these as sex crimes. I think they're gender crimes. I don't think they're sex crimes. Well, it's quite interesting because all of these women were killed in supine positions. So they were reclining. And as I mentioned before, there seemed to be no wounds indicating any sort of a struggle. And also nobody, as far as we know, heard anything. So it would strike me, and all of these women, well, Polly, Annie, and Catherine Eddowes had a history of sleeping rough. And we know they were sleeping rough at least several nights of the week.
By the way, everybody, sleeping rough is sleeping on the street.
Sleeping on the street.
That's what we call it here. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
And Mary Jane Kelly was killed in her bed, which is another interesting aspect of this. So it seems to me that it struck me that, well, this is the sort of missing piece in all of this, that, you know, obviously this explains a lot of this, that this is somebody who's around, who's prowling for somebody who is an easy victim. He knows the back streets. He knows where homeless people are likely to sleep, and he gets them in their sleep. It makes perfect sense.
So after Mary Polly Nichols was killed, that was August 31st of 1888. A week later, Annie Chapman, her body is found. She was a sex worker. She was 47 years old. She did have two regular clients, a guy named Harry the Hawker and Ted Stanley. Her body was found in the backyard of 29 Hanbury Street at around 6 a.m. on the 8th. You know, she had also been in the autopsy. It was revealed that a lot of her, we're not going to get into graphic detail here, but a lot of her insides had been removed. Now, when you're thinking about the women who might have been murdered while they were sleeping, or at least came upon while they were sleeping, which of the four, because we're going to leave Mary Kelly towards the end because she was, that was a different circumstance, but which of the four does it seem most likely that they were killed in their sleep?
Well, that would be Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman. Annie Chapman was actually found in a place where it was mentioned a homeless person was found sleeping shortly after her body was removed. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Hanbury Yard was known for a lot of things, and people slept rough in Hanbury Yard as well.
Right.
Catherine Eddowes, who'd spent basically her life sleeping rough, are the ones most likely. Elizabeth Stride had probably slept rough. I even would question whether she was a victim of the Ripper at all for a number of reasons. But she is the one whose murder is slightly different than the others, and I'm sure we'll come on to that.
Right.
So primarily those three, and then Mary Jane Kelly killed indoors in her bed.
Which is the one that everybody, you know, it's like when they did the movie, the Jack the Ripper movie with Johnny Depp, that's the one that they focused on. It seems like everybody focuses on that when she was the youngest.
Yeah.
Going to talk to her about her for a second. Yeah. Elizabeth Stride, 3 weeks later, she used to clean rooms at the lodging house. She would go to the Queen's Head pub, and her body was discovered around 1 a.m. And all it really says is her throat was slashed. Right.
Yeah.
That was really it. So there was no disemboweling. There was nothing that was going on there, which leads it to two things. One, this is a different person, or that what would you say, Paul?
Well, you know, in terms of taking a look at the timeline, you know, she was seen with a man, I think starting around, 11 o'clock at night at Bricklayer's Arms. And then she sighted with that man all the way up until 12:45 a.m., and her body is found at 1 a.m. Is that correct?
Well, there's a lot of question. I mean, there's a lot of question as to whether that man was actually with her or not. And the witnesses who claim to have seen this, I mean, their testimony can be completely ripped apart. You know, it was late at night. There was, no light around. So it's highly questionable whether she was actually seen with these people. Also, going back to what Billy was saying, I would also argue there's no evidence to suggest that Annie Chapman was a sex worker either. There is hearsay, but there is actually no hard evidence at all. Elizabeth Stride was a sex worker. Yeah. We know that because she appears in police records as somebody who was soliciting. And also, she's originally from Sweden. When she lived in Sweden, she was on the official register of prostitutes, the police register. Mm-hmm. And we know she left the country and she attempted to leave her past behind her.
So because these are so different than the other, this scene is so different than the other five, it could be a different person, or it could have been that somebody came upon the killer before he was able to disembowel. That's a possibility.
Yeah.
That's certainly one of the arguments, was that the killer was interrupted in the middle of murdering her. I think the method of murder is so different and the circumstances are so different that my instinct is that Elizabeth Stride was not a victim of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I was going with, in terms of, you know, why would there be a difference if it's the same offender? And it could be an interrupted attack. He's not being able to spend as much time with this victim as he can with the other victims, most notably the one victim that was inside a room.
So then we get to Catherine Eddowes, and this was the same night. Correct? Or the same day?
Yes, it was. It was shortly after. And it was believed that he was interrupted while he was killing Elizabeth Stride. And then he had to run across town to Mitre Square, where she was found, and murder somebody else.
Right.
I think that would be quite hard to pull off. You know, somebody would be covered in blood. Even that late at night, it would be a risk that I wonder if anybody would be taking at a time when people were looking for this killer on the loose.
Well, now we're talking. Okay, so you said covered in blood, and that's something I probably want to address right here, because right now, at least with Elizabeth Stride, we just have her throat being slashed once, right? And so we don't have the disembowelment. We don't have, you know, the defensive injuries. He's not spending a lot of time with the body. I will tell you that the likelihood, if all he's doing is cutting her throat, the likelihood of him having any visible blood on him is very low. He probably has very little. And so therefore, if he is the same person that goes on and crosses town, he's probably able to move freely without anybody having any suspicion. People walk upon a bloody scene and think, oh, the offender must have got blood all over him. Well, most of that blood has been shed after the offender has left, as her heart is pumping and the neck wound is expressing blood. So a single throat slash in all likelihood would not result in a lot of blood on the offender.
Thanks so much for joining us. This conversation is so fascinating. We're going to finish it next week. But in the meantime, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. It's just Hallie Ribbenhold, my name.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. We really do appreciate it. We will be back next week. Subscribe, get some merch, follow us on social, follow Hallie on social. And until then, keep digging.
And don't be an irony. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.